This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
Who's going to speak about health policy landscape for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities? Claudia Center is the legal director of the Disability Rights Education and Defense Fund. Claudia was previously a senior staff attorney at the Disability Rights California program of the National ACLU Foundation. She played a key role in the passage of comprehensive amendments to the Fair Employment and Housing Act and has successfully argued before the Supreme Court for reasonable accommodations for disabled employees. She served as an adjunct professor teaching disability rights at Hastings College of Law and at Berkeley Law. So welcome, Claudia Center.
Thank you, Clarissa. This is Claudia Center. As Clarissa said, I'm a legal director at DREDEF, Disability Rights Education and Defense Fund, and we are a disability-led organization with large majorities of our staff and board being people with disabilities and also parents of children with disabilities. I'm here to talk a little bit about the health policy landscape for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. At DREDEF and at prior jobs, I've represented many people with developmental disabilities, in part because the legal services system in California automatically qualifies people with developmental disabilities for legal services. And I hope that that's true in other states as well. So I should have done us a trigger warning here, but a lot of the federal policy is pretty dark. We all are going to work together and fight for good policy for people with developmental disabilities and all kinds of disabilities. But it's not a bright time in health policy. So my friend and colleague Maria Towne of AAPD is going to talk in more depth about what's going on with Medicaid, but I'm sure you all heard that there are massive cuts to Medicaid from the federal bill HR 1 with new requirements designed to shrink the people who are eligible for the expansion population, in other words, people who get Medicaid because of expansion. So that's based on income rather than disability. And so I just want to flag that that will affect people with developmental disabilities, but most adults with IDD qualify for Medicaid based on disability, so not subject to the new requirements. But it is something to watch out for. And what we are advocating to our states who have to implement these requirements is that there's an exemption to the work requirements for medically frail, quote unquote, or has special medical needs, quote unquote. And we're wanting those states to apply those very broadly to exempt, for example, people who are getting in California services from the regional center. And that's not because we don't think people with developmental disabilities should participate in work. It's because these requirements have been shown to eliminate people from health insurance coverage and not to promote, you know, employment. So, and Maria will speak more about this. We also, of course, if you've been reading the news, which is probably not a healthy activity these days, there have been massive staff cuts at HHS, the Department of Health and Human Services, which is the agency which implements federal health policy. So about 18% of the workforce has been cut, including a large number of staff, over 1,000 from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. And that's the agency which handles things like waivers or benchmark plans, like very important things about how healthcare is delivered. the Administration for Community Living, which is the Federal Center for Policy on Aging and Disability, obviously critical to us here, has been slashed by about half. And the Office for Civil Rights has also had staff cuts. And so this is very challenging situation, and we have to work together even more. Lawyers, doctors, healthcare providers, because we have to reach solutions in the inter for at least for right now, outside of any help from the federal HHS. We have several challenges to Olmstead, and Olmstead is the case by the Supreme Court that talked about something we call the integration mandate. And this is the idea that people with disabilities, including developmental disabilities, have the right to live in the community with supports like in-home support care or supported employment or, whatever it is, home and community-based services, if they want to, and they can do that. If people are forced into institutions to receive needed care, that's a violation of disability rights, because those services can be provided in the community successfully, and people can live in the community with supports. So we have 9 states right now who have brought a case against the federal government, claiming that some new rules that clarified and detailed the integration mandate are unconstitutional. They're basically saying they shouldn't have an obligation to provide services in the community unless the person seeking services is already in the institution. So it's really terrible. And we have called on at disability advocates in all 9 states to contact their attorneys general, their governors, and to say that they support Olmstead and they demand that their state drop out of this case. So that's not great news. We also have the White House and CMS attacking services that are vital to our community as fraud and putting up roadblocks to these services, including in-home support services and durable medical equipment. So that's a very challenging environment as well. So we, Dredf and our partners, including my colleague Maria Towne, who's going to come with the American Association of People with Disabilities, we have been working together on defending Olmstead and people with developmental disabilities. Many have grown up with Olmstead, and we believe in the right to live in the community with supports. We believe in the right to participate in programs with non-disabled people, for example, school and employment. And so we're going to have to really stick together and make noise to fight back against these challenges. In the meantime, we have seen Olmstead successes. Dredf and our partners have recently published a report about 3 states, Virginia, North Carolina, and Georgia, showing how Olmstead enforcement has strengthened community-based services and supports, and particularly housing. And housing was mentioned in our introductory remarks. Housing is, foundational to people living in the community with supports. So on the brighter side, we have some really important Section 504 regulations that were finalized in May 2024 that include many provisions that are helpful for people with developmental disabilities. And Section 504 applies to basically all healthcare providers. And that's because virtually all healthcare providers, whether they are part of the government or whether they are private, receive federal dollars in some way, whether through Medicare or Medicaid or another way. And so virtually, I mean, there is the oddball somewhere that doesn't fall under this, but virtually every healthcare provider is subject to Section 504. And so there are some really important provisions in the May 2024 regulations that support people with IDD, including the requirement of effective communication. Meaning that communication with people with disabilities should be as effective as communication with non-disabled people, and that could include working with supporters and using plain language. There are requirements for accessible medical equipment. There's a really important requirement for non-discrimination in medical treatment. It used to be that courts would say, well, you can have a malpractice case if you think somebody acted negligently in medical care, but you can't separately have a disability discrimination case that someone treated you badly in medical care based on your disability. And we very recently got a case out of the Fifth Circuit that held that no, you can have a discrimination case based on discrimination in medical treatment. So that's a really important foundational principle that I'm sure we all thought was already established. But in fact, this is a very important case from the Fifth Circuit, and that's a very conservative circuit. So you can see how, disabilities still sometimes we have, cross popular, we have appeal and allies in sometimes in surprising places. We also have from those 504 regulations that all of the non-discrimination rules apply to child welfare agencies and programs. And I imagine you all know that people with intellectual and developmental disabilities are at enormous risks of having children removed from the home and termination of parental rights because these disabled parents do not receive the supports and services that are appropriate to them and that they need. So this is very important. I want to also reference the immigration crackdowns at the federal government that have spread out across the country and at the borders and all sorts of places not at the borders. And while that might not seem like a disability issue or a developmental disability issue, it actually is. People with developmental disabilities like Wael Tarabishi have lost their caregivers. These could be family or non-family caregivers who are immigrants. There have been many really awful stories about disabled people and the immigration crackdown, but one that's relevant to the developmental disability community is the death of Wael Tarabishi after his father, caregiver, was taken into detention and could no longer care for his son, and he died. We have situations where ICE agents are interacting with disabled people without accommodation and harming them physically and in other ways, and people with disabilities in detention being denied access to assistive devices, effective communication, medication. So it is a disability issue. On a little more positive note, we have continued recognition of supported decision making. Of course, California has supported decision making. 39 states and DC have supported decision making. And many of us in the disability rights legal community use supported decision making in legal representation. We train about supported decision making. And I recently, for example, got a judge to remove a guardian ad litem, which is sort of like a legal decision maker, in a court case talking about how I was using supported decision making with the client. And that meant that that client could then make his own decisions in the settlement that we reached this week. So I think supported decision making is really important. And so my key takeaway here is, it's a really challenging time for health policy, but we have enormous strength as a community when we work together. DREDF and AAPD, our partner organization, and some of our other sibling organizations, we have generated that literally thousands of emails and phone calls and meetings and news reports. Telling, for example, the federal government not to roll back disability rights, telling those state AGs and the governors in those nine states, do not roll back disability rights. We have had some successes in getting certain regulations that were proposed unproposed. We haven't had enough success, but I'm just saying that we are working together very collaboratively and strongly, and working together is what really matters right now during this challenging time. And we'll continue to work together to protect Section 504, Olmstead, the ADA, all of our rights. And so I'll stop speaking now. And I think we may have questions and answers.
Hi, thank you so much. That was incredible and so much to process, Claudia. As the questions are coming in, I wanted to talk about Olmstead a little bit and get some of your perspective. Olmstead, the Olmstead decision was very important in the age of deinstitutionalization, and we still have some institutions in this country, but in California, all of our institutions are closed. And we had a deal across the political spectrum where fiscal conservatives like Ronald Reagan would support deinstitutionalization, and people who were interested in disability rights were supporting deinstitutionalization on the left, and it was less expensive and better quality of care, so it was win-win to close an institution and serve people in the community. But with the institutions gone, what's our leverage? We can't save any money by closing institutions because the institutions are gone. And so what do we do now?
So that's a great question, Clarissa. And just to clarify, Clarissa is referring to the institutions for people with developmental disabilities. There's a whole other set of issues around mental health, hospitals, et cetera. But I think that what we work together, what we do is we work together on our shared understanding of what our rights are. And there is agreement really across, well, I hope, across the aisle that people with disabilities are entitled to supports in the community. I don't think the nine states' attorneys general are, I don't think that they are speaking for the majority in any way. I think that there are families and adult children and people with disabilities across the country who've grown up with Olmstead, who've grown up with living in the community. And we really need to, I mean, you know, when we don't have the White House, we don't have Congress, we don't have the Supreme Court, what we have is people power right now. And so that's why Dredf and our partners, we're working on state law, but we're also working on people power and getting our community to get the word out. And really, you know, we're on the right side of history, of logic, of expectation. And so I don't know exactly what the path will be, other than we're going to keep pushing hard to defend Olmstead. But even this White House's HHS is still enforcing Olmstead. I mean, not as much as the prior administration. So, you know, we're just gotta keep pushing, making noise, and believe that our social expectations will prevail in some way.
A follow-up question to that is, are there ways that healthcare professionals can join in advocating, like organizations or websites, or how do we get involved?
Absolutely, especially organizations or people that are have chapters or live in the nine states. I think it is great for those providers and organizations to reach out, request a meeting, show up for a meeting, you know, without, if they won't give you an appointment, show up and demand an appointment, make phone calls, send letters, you know, make noise, talk to reporters. Make it really clear, that this is not acceptable to any of the stakeholders in this world. People with disabilities, their providers, their family members, their supporters, their institutions, and so on, meaning social institutions.
I want to thank you for that. We all, I think many of us feel numb. There's so much going on that the Q&A is kind of silent. I want to circle back to what you were talking about, the 504 requirements for effective communication. So, are those in effect right now? And do they apply to regional centers and schools and other places where people who are non-speaking, who have found effective ways to communicate through pointing to letters on a letterboard or through methods that maybe are idiosyncratic to them, maybe methods that they worked out with their parent or with a but have no evidence to support them, but they're helping them to live better lives and to participate in education and their lives. Are organizations able to say, well, that's not evidence-based, so we can't spend home and community-based money on it, or we won't allow you to use your kind of your method of communication because we don't believe in it, or we think it's not evidence-based enough. Is that legal?
That's a really good question. Healthcare providers are covered by 504 and have to use non-standard communication methods to comply with effective communication. Regional centers, I'd have to go look at and do an analysis of whether they're getting federal funds. Certainly, a lot of their contracting agencies get federal funds. And so it would be covered by Section 504. There's also state laws that are similar that definitely cover regional centers. So they do have to provide effective communication. If the provider believed it wasn't effective communication because they believed it wasn't evidence-based, that would be sort of a dispute on the facts, and so it would kind of vary, but I think it would be if that's the ordinary way that the person communicates, that's a very powerful fact for using that in the healthcare environment. I also I forgot to mention another thing, and I feel that it's remiss of me not to mention it, is a lot of the rhetoric coming out of the administration and HHS is very ableist and even eugenics-y. And there's so many terrible things that I didn't include it, but I don't want to stop my remarks without referencing, all the myths about autism and all the myths about other developmental disabilities and stereotypes that are being said by the people in power. And we just need to strengthen our linkages, like through things like this conference, to just push back on that. But I think that effective communication question is a little tricky, but I think the disabled person probably has the better argument.
Thank you. Following up on that, there's so many things, and we can't get distracted or fail to be persistent or get overwhelmed. So there was a question: if you had to focus on three things that are terrible, but that might be reversible with enough political pressure, what would they be, and who are the Republicans who might be allies?
Oh gosh, that might be outside of my expertise. I can do the three things. I think the three things are Medicaid, probably Medicaid, 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 but Medicaid, which we definitely can reverse. I think the civil rights structure in Washington, D.C., meaning the offices for civil rights in the departments that are critical to us, like Department of Education, Department of Justice, Department of Health and Human Services, those can be restored, but it's gonna take much longer to rebuild them than it took to destroy them because expertise was lost. And yeah, I'll say those two. Medicaid, we can reverse it, and the civil rights enforcement arms, we can restore, but both of them, Medicaid can probably be restored quicker if we have the right votes, but then what's happened in the community in terms of what the impacts of the funding cuts and then the civil rights enforcement, those two.
Thank you. We have a question about obtaining DEXA scans, which are scans for osteoporosis in Santa Rosa, because the hospital scanners aren't set up with the Hoyer lifts, the lifts so that people can get into the equipment. Does the law apply to this as well? And how do you persuade hospital systems to make their equipment accessible?
Yes, the law applies to them, and they should. I mean, a Hoyer lift is pretty basic. They should be doing that. A lawyer, possibly a legal aid lawyer, would need to kind of look at all the facts and look at the reg and, figure out what the best argument is. But yes, they absolutely should be doing that. The doctor could make a request to legal counsel of the entity. Sometimes that fixes things quicker. But yes, they should be following the law about medical equipment.
Great. Another question. How do I support a young patient with mental health issues who's being turned away from residential treatment locally due to needing a wheelchair? Is that illegal? Several places in our area are saying that they can turn somebody away because they need they for their mental health treatment because they use a wheelchair.
So, that's a very important question and another tricky one. And basically, what the lawyer does is goes up a step. So, it's not that every individual treatment place has to be wheelchair accessible. It's that the entire system that is presumably being overseen by the county department of mental health or behavioral health or whatever it is, that county is supposed to be entering into contracts and arrangements with a sufficient number of wheelchair accessible programs. And so that's where it's not that, I mean, I wish that all the individual programs were wheelchair accessible, but legally, where you want to hit is the county level and say, look, if you have these, you need to figure out a placement. And if you can't find someone to do it as a contractor, you need to do it directly. Like, you can't have this referral system and not have wheelchair accessible placements.
Thank you. That's very important. There's so many co-occurring disabilities in it, and people can't just think in terms of one organ system, or they got to think about the whole person in their community. Let's see. There are still regional center consumers being pressured to go to institutional care, especially if they use ventilators. Their people are being sent now to SNF, to nursing facilities. Is there anything that we can do to make sure that we have adequate options for people to live in the community when they have that kind of medical complexity?
Well, people with very complex medical needs, do live in the community with supports. We had our introductory speakers talked about Alice Wong. She's one of many who lives or lived in the community with supports. It does require a lot of advocacy to get those supports in the community. It shouldn't, but it does. And part of that is that under Medicaid, those services are typically provided under waiver programs. This is a little bit in the weeds, but that means that it's not a endless pot. It's like a pot with a cap on it. So it can be harder to get those services in the community, but we know that people do it. And I think using examples of people who do it now or in the past and say, look, this is possible, and continuing to fight for that. One of the issues is finding caregivers who will work for the wages that are provided. And that's another way that the federal cuts to Medicaid have been challenging, because it is hard to push California to raise wages for in-home support personnel when they are trying to deal with the cuts to Medicaid. And that's why, we have to raise taxes is the only way to. That right now that we can do anything with these massive federal cuts. And California has a lot of millionaires and billionaires, so.
I have patients in my practice who live in the community on ventilators and live in community homes with 24-hour nursing. And so it definitely is and can be done. And yes, the wages for nurses is way under what they can make in a hospital, and that is, increasingly a problem. If you think in AAC training and device would be needed for a patient to communicate with one of your patients with intellectual and developmental disabilities, and you're a healthcare provider, how do you request the funds to get the supplies covered?
Oh gosh, I'm sorry, I don't know the answer to that question.
Okay, I think if you go on the Office of Developmental Primary Care website, there's a toolkit written called Everyone Communicates, and that has a lot of information on how to get AAC assessments and equipment funded and which programs are responsible for it. So that's an option.
Is that from Communication First?
No, that actually that's Office of Developmental Primary Care, but it was written by Sam Crane, who at the time she wrote it
Right.
was with the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network, but is now the policy director of Communication First. So Communication First is another good resource for anything related to people who have difficulty with speech to communicate. And
Thank you
so
for sharing those important resources.
yeah, thank you. Another question coming in. There's a long history of community mental health and psychiatric hospitals declining to provide care for intellectual and developmental disabilities. Any ideas on how to address this?
Well, that is definitely unlawful under our regulations. But that doesn't mean that, healthcare institutions are following the law. I guess, gosh, I would, call the patients' rights advocate. I would call the protection and advocacy cert agency in your state, and you can go to NDRN, National Disability Rights Network. That's the umbrella organization, and find the protection and advocacy organization in your state. But that is definitely not supposed to happen. I know, of course, I'm not naive. I know it happens all the time. But if you follow the law, you're not supposed to exclude people based on disability.
It's complicated because I think the clinical expertise for people with IDD is often different, and the environments where people thrive are often different, and it's combined often the psychiatric disabilities with medical problems where it might be unsafe to be in a psychiatric hospital ward. So there are many layered issues whether we should be pushing for people to access those generic resources, those general psychiatric hospitals, or we should be creating something that's especially for our population. And I think with psychiatry, you can make arguments that maybe we need some specialized services. They're not a perfect match for the clinicians or for the patients.
That makes a lot of sense. And it's sort of that same issue of going to the county level and saying, okay, what's your inpatient, crisis stabilization option for people with a mental health crisis, a psychiatric diagnosis, who also are developmentally disabled? And it's not, again, not every, place has to be perfectly situated, but they have to offer something.
Good point. Good point. And one final question. If school age, can we talk a little about schools and IEPs and what's happening at the school level on a policy level right now? And how do we fight for education rights in this environment?
Well, a lot of the educational rights under Section 504 or the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act are in statute, which means that the current administration cannot easily, delete them. The challenge is more that the enforcement structure at the federal level has been sort of slashed. And so there's not an Office of Civil Rights that you can go to and expect support in fixing a problem in the school. And so that means, again, the rights are there, but you have to, in my, mostly you have to find non-federal resources to help you enforce the rights. And so that means, oh, sorry, we also still have the parent training and information centers, which are federally contracted services, and those contracts have been continued for the time being. So I think parents and families and students need to learn about their rights, enforce their rights, maybe find a lawyer or an advocate to work with them. There's an umbrella organization called COPA, the, I think it's, I don't know if it's Council or Coalition of Parent Attorneys and Advocates, and that's a really important network. So those rights are still there, and we should fight to enforce them rigor, fully.
Is there a role for you said, sometimes the only thing that's intact is people power, for IEP and special education for K through 12. Is there a role for people power in enforcing IEP rights and special education rights?
Yeah, I think so. One of the points that people in the nine states are making in their outreach to the state AGs and the governors is that the integration mandate applies to schools as well, and keeping people in classrooms that are general ed classrooms that have disabled and non-disabled students. And that was that's something that people in the nine states can do. Last year, we had 17 states in the case, and they were trying to say that all of Section 504 was unconstitutional. And the people power last year got the states to say, oh, no, we're not making that argument anymore. So we did have a victory last year directly as a result of people power. So we have to keep doing that.
Thank you so much. This has really been illuminating and so helpful, and gives us some ideas about how to move forward in this environment. Thank you. I deeply appreciate your expertise today and for starting us off with such strong comments.
Thank you, Clarissa, and thanks for inviting me.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.